This is the Steve Cochran Show, live from the Allstate Showcase Studio on Chicago's very own
720 WGN.
842. Sadly, along with the obvious ramifications for the nation, the death of Antonin Scalia, even before his family has been given proper respect or time to grieve, the political argument started. The political arguments are important, but it's important to remember the man, and a gentleman now joins us who knew him very well, and he is the Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago after a long career as an author and law professor at Chicago, at the University of Chicago himself, and also somebody that knew Scalia from his days as a law professor. Here's Jeffrey Stone. Good morning, Mr. Stone. How are you?
Okay. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on, and I wanted to take a few minutes here and remember your friend, Justice Scalia, because I don't think we've taken enough time to do that, because we know he was a legal genius, but what kind of a guy was he?
He had two personas. I mean, Scalia, in his interpersonal relations with people like myself who disagree with him about pretty much everything, he was always congenial, lively, bright, engaging, liked to argue, somebody who I always felt great affection for and great respect for, even though we disagreed about everything. His public persona, which he created, was a very different one. It was someone who was intemperate and sometimes nasty and impolite. And so there were really two different visions of Scalia. And, you know, the fact that the people on the court who were his closest friends were Elena Kagan and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who, like me, very much disagree with Scalia, speaks a lot about the interpersonal side of him. But as I said, the personal persona was something I think he created. I think he wanted that because he knew getting attention was a way to have influence.
And would you call it as much as a character as anything else? Because he was able to do his job professionally at the highest level, but he could still be this public character, because when you become a Supreme Court judge, you're a very famous individual.
Well, most Supreme Court justices actually aren't very famous. Most of them are pretty anonymous to the American public. I don't think very many people know much about Alito, for example, or John Roberts, or knew much about David Souter. Scalia made himself into a public figure by putting himself forward. He once told me that the reason he expressed himself in his opinions with such vehemence, and the reason he, in his speeches, would be so outspoken, was in part because he wanted people to pay attention to his ideas. And the way to get the media, the way to get law professors, the way to get law students to pay attention to his ideas was to be a character, was to be somebody who people talked about.
.849, Jeffrey R. Stone, Edward H. Levy Distinguished Service Professor at the University of Chicago, a man who knew Justice Antonin Scalia very well. Would you explain to us, Mr. Stone, what an originalist is?
So an originalist, which is the philosophy of interpretation that Justice Scalia avidly propounded, is someone who basically takes the view that a court should invalidate a law as unconstitutional only if that law was one that the framers and ratifiers of a particular constitutional provision themselves anticipated would be unconstitutional under that provision. So, for example, take the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, which provides that no state shall deny to any person the equal protection of the laws. An originalist would say that a law that prohibited African Americans from serving on juries violates the Equal Protection Clause, because that's precisely the type of law the framers and ratifiers at the time the clause was adopted had in mind. That's what they wanted to outlaw. On the other hand, imagine a law that says that women can't be lawyers, or that gays and lesbians can't marry. And the question is, does that violate the Equal Protection Clause? An originalist would say, no, that does not violate the Equal Protection Clause, because we know that the people who drafted the Equal Protection Clause a century and a half ago did not anticipate or affirmatively intend, that this is what the Equal Protection Clause would do. The alternative method of constitutional interpretation basically says that the framers were not originalists. They didn't intend to cabin the meaning of the words in that way. They understood they were putting a principle into the Constitution, and that the principle could evolve over time. And therefore, if over later time, we could see that laws discriminating against women had many of the characteristics of laws discriminating against African Americans, that it would be appropriate to apply the Equal Protection Clause to them as well. So that's the difference between Scalia's originalist approach and the more conventional approach to constitutional interpretation.
Yeah, and I think you run into the same problems with the Bible and everything else where you go, well, I'm going to interpret the intent of those who are no longer here to clarify their intent. Having said that, counterarguments are easy to make as well. And here we are at the epitome of irony or hypocrisy, depending on your point of view, that people are standing up, and I'll use Marco Rubio as an example, standing up and saying we have to honor Justice Scalia, and by honoring him, we're not going to allow the President of the United States to nominate someone to replace him, which is a direct violation of the intent of the Constitution.
Yes, I would agree with that. I think that position is completely unconscionable. It's unprecedented in American history. It flies in the face of 225 years of tradition. No one who takes that position is being a responsible legislator or public citizen. It is truly incompatible in the most direct way with all of our constitutional tradition and all of the understandings of the Constitution.
Jeffrey, obviously, he was a very staunch conservative, but a brilliant justice. What do you think he would say about the potential partisan wrangling that's about to ensue and that has already ensued over this?
I would guess that if Scalia were looking at the question as a matter of principle, he would clearly say it is the responsibility of the Senate to advise and consent. The president is elected until his term of office is over. If the president presents a nominee who is qualified for the Supreme Court, it is the duty of the Senate to listen to that confirmation nomination and to make a reasoned, appropriate judgment. And one thing I can say is in the last 60 years, for example, there's not been a single instance in which the Senate, even when controlled by the opposing party, has turned down a nomination of a candidate who has been regarded as moderate and qualified. Not a single one. And for the Senate to say we're not going to listen to any nomination is completely unacceptable.
Yeah, and frankly, political suicide on some level, because the Republican Party has turned into this circular firing squad. And it takes moderates and undecided voters and goes, well, here's an entire party that's decided to ignore the Constitution they claim that we have to all honor. So, again, I don't understand the lunacy of it. But then again, how could you understand anything related to campaign 2016 at this point? Appreciate your insight very much, and congratulations on all of your success, and you're certainly welcome here.
Thank you very much. My pleasure. Have a great day.
There you go. It's Jeffrey R. Stone from the University of Chicago, amongst as many other places of note.